From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made yesterday when Syracuse University announced it had established a special committee that will review and develop diversity and inclusion policies on campus. That move came about 2 months after a series of racist and anti-Semitic incidents happened at Syracuse. Students responded to hate messages graffitied on buildings with a two-week sit-in and a list of their own demands. Most of those demands were accepted by the university's chancellor. SU's new committee and related efforts reflect what's happening at many colleges and universities across the country. Structural responses to cultural issues and crises on campus. Inside Higher Ed reports that more institutions now have chief diversity officers than ever before. But what exactly do those positions entail? How do colleges and universities make decisions about the roles and responsibilities of diversity offices? And how do they measure results? How do they know if what they're doing is working? This hour, we're joined by some of the people in those offices, local chief diversity officers and others who are sharing how their institutions are providing structural responses to these issues. And while missions and ideals are important when it comes to these efforts, this is a conversation about boots-on-the-ground initiatives, tangible results. We want to know what kinds of conversations diversity officers are having with students, with faculty, and what kinds of change those conversations have generated or could still generate in the weeks and months to come. A lot to discuss this hour. And hello to all of our guests. I will introduce them now. Diana Riza is Vice President for Community and Belonging at Nazareth College. Diane, welcome. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Hello to Dr. Cephas Archie, who's Chief Diversity Officer at the College at Brockport. Welcome. Thanks for being here.
Pleasure to be here.
Dr. Calvin Gant is Chief Diversity Officer at MCC, Monroe Community College. Calvin, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And Dr. Keith Jenkins is Vice President and Associate Provost for Diversity and Inclusion at RIT. Welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
In a moment, we'll tell you what's coming up on Friday at NAS. They've got an event with Kamau Bell, and they're going to talk about ending racism there. But before we get to that event coming up here, I want all of you, if you could, to let our listeners know a little bit about what exactly it is you're doing. Because, you know, I don't know the exact date, I mean, but it was maybe 3 years ago now, something like that. The University of Rochester had its own issues and demands for offices like this, hiring of more people of color in various places, a lot of different demands. So what's happening at Syracuse is not sort of a one-off. We're seeing this in a lot of places around the country. And every, I think, probably serious institution is talking about what do we do in a kind of a real effective way. So if you can, I'm going to go around the table. I'll start with Dr. Cephas Archie, and I'll ask you to describe your work and how long you've been doing it, where you are. So you're at the College of Brockport.
Sure. So I've been at the College of Brockport since about August 2017. So I'm in my third academic year now. And I, my position was developed out of the SUNY University Faculty Senate passed legislature or resolution back in 2015 that was supported by the Board of Trustees. And what it specifically identified was that every SUNY campus was to establish a chief diversity officer. And so that created a precedent that remains throughout all of the SUNY institutional structures that really make it not only a goal, but a priority of our system. And so that was really imperative for us to have a systemic change versus only serving as a one-off or an isolated initiative. It's so how are we making these things our values that we are driving through our actions every day? And so in that time that I've been there, we have been really becoming more intentional. Our college's partnerships, both internal and external, have been the real driving force. Our faculty, our senate, our students have been the trajectors or the projectors, if you would, of the work that we've been leading, even developing an institutional equity, diversity, and inclusion strategic plan that is filled with objectives and annual benchmarks and how are we tracking the data that correlate to what that work is and how are we quantifying that in a meaningful but also a sustainably measurable component. And so with these things, we're working with our community partners, with our local K-12 school districts who have aligned values and priorities as well, and it really uses the resources that we have, as we are aware that our success is inextricably linked to the region's success, the K-12 success. And so how are we partnering to really flesh that out to have a operationalized strategy of what that looks like to really become not just diverse, but inclusive and more equitable in all of our efforts? So we could sit here for days and talk about all that we're doing, and I don't want to do that, but I want to highlight the work of our President's Council on Diversity and Inclusion, who are doing phenomenal work and really allowing us to be partners.
And briefly, before I turn to some of the other guests here, when you talk about annual benchmarks, when you talk about actual data. Some of what we'll talk about today are things that can be quantified. Mm-hmm. And some is probably not quantifiable,
sure,
just in terms of whether students feel safe, supported, whether true inclusion and a respect and celebration of diversity is happening. It can be hard to quantify, but there are certain things that are benchmarkable.
Absolutely.
So what's one example of a benchmark? Just one kind of.
Well, a benchmark is to literally look at the number of underrepresented groups of employees that you have at your college. And so that's a quantifiable benchmark, looking at data-driven outcomes that are formulated by the Department of Education as the groups that we measure and assess. And so looking at that data, our plan puts into place what are we doing to keep said employees and to recruit and bring them in. And so at the end of every academic year, we look at all the things that we've done, and we also correlate that to what are the outcomes that are they actually impacting the outcomes that we've had, which is to retain and increase those numbers with personnel. And so it's, again, looking at what are you doing, but also is it having the impact that you are actually aligning to have as a result of. And so there are many data-driven outcomes that are there. It just takes us becoming more intentional and having the same focus that we have with all other institutional priorities when it comes to the work that we've identified.
All right, Diane is Vice President for Community and Belonging at Nazareth College. Tell me about the work you're doing there and how long you've been there doing it.
I've been at Nazareth for 2 years, and I would underscore everything that Karchi has said. And I would probably talk about two areas of focus that I think for all chief diversity officers, one is education and the other one is communication, and then accountability. I would say that is one that, how do we think about the work that we're doing and being held accountable? And when doing this work, I think you're looking at not just benchmarking, but also building relationships. And it's not just focused on our underrepresented populations, which is critical, hiring more employees, recruiting more students, more faculty are important. But how do we create a climate that's sustainable, making it a place where we just shifted our title of our division from diversity and inclusion to community and belonging. And for us, belonging was an area that we wanted to focus on because it spoke to, I'm not coming here just to enter higher ed to get a degree. I'm also in the classroom, but how is my whole self, everything that I'm a part of is really true to the community that I'm in? So a lot of the work that we're trying to do is educating both in the classroom and outside of the classroom. And I can give you many examples, but I think all of us could talk about training and development and educating around how do we bring majority students understanding this work as well, that it's not on the heels and on the shoulders of underrepresented faculty, staff, and students, but how do we get allyship to be part of this work? And so one of the areas that we're focused on is providing these experiential opportunities outside of the classroom that is beyond curriculum. How do we think about race, ethnicity, sexuality? I know that we're gearing up for MLK and we all focus on the one day, but how are we doing this 365 days? And so how do we think about the work that we're doing in the classroom, critical in curriculum, but also how do we develop student leadership around this area?
Okay. Dr. Jenkins is Vice President and Associate Provost for Diversity and Inclusion at RIT. Keith, why don't you tell me about your work and how long you've been doing it there?
Okay. I'm Keith Jenkins, and I'm in my 28th year at Rochester Institute of Technology. And I did not start in this particular arena. I'm faculty in the School of Communication there. I'm a professor. My areas of expertise is really intercultural communication. This is my second stint, actually, in the work of diversity and inclusion. I started out in 1999 as the first assistant provost for diversity, and the focus at that time was on the access and success of students, faculty, as well as staff at RIT. I stayed in that role for approximately 3 years, returned to the classroom where we were able to establish a degree in journalism, but in 2016 returned to this space, operating as the vice president and associate provost for diversity and inclusion. I would say that RIT, when I arrived in 1992, there was a commitment already to diversity and inclusion. That commitment was manifested in the president's commission on pluralism. And that particular role primarily oversaw things such as the Expressions of King's Legacy, which is our celebratory program recognizing Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. But it also looked at ways that we could create interactions between individuals of diverse populations at RIT. That particular position has grown into what we look at today as a vice president and associate provost for diversity and inclusion. There is a division that is committed to this work that houses approximately 39 staff members. The work that flows out of this division, for example, includes things such as a diversity theater unit. Diversity theater focuses on those climate issues and how we can enhance a more inclusive climate, not only in the colleges, but also in student clubs and organizations, as well as in staff positions that we may have at the university. You also have an Office of Faculty Diversity and Recruitment. Now, this particular office is recognized because we do what is called the Future Faculty Career Exploration Program. That program invites individuals who are aspiring scholars to our campus to spend a period of time from approximately a Wednesday through a Sunday where they are exposed to faculty, they're exposed to departments, they're exposed to many different aspects of not only RIT, but the greater community in which we live. So those are opportunities where we do outreach in that particular way. The work continues with Mosaic. Mosaic is referred to by some as RIT's living room. It's that space where individuals gather to really discuss some of those tough topics of race, whether there's inclusivity as it relates to spirituality and religion. How do we deal with issues based on sexuality? And so how do we deal with these things, talk about these things in a very respectful and inclusive way? So these are some of the activities that are underway at RIT at this time.
Okay. Dr. Gant, Chief Diversity Officer at Monroe Community College, tell us about your work.
Okay, so I've been at Monroe Community College for a little less than 2 years. I came in August of 2018. And the work at MCC, I think a little bit different than my colleagues here, because we are a community college, we don't always have the same opportunities to be able to build community in the same ways. And so we really do have to look at what we do in terms of diversity, really from a different standpoint. Certainly, just like our colleagues here, we're focused on trying to make sure that we increase our faculty and staff. For us, 47% of our students, are from underrepresented backgrounds. So bringing up the entire faculty and staff ratio to be able to be more reflective of the student population really for us is a major thing to be taken into consideration. And so, you know, my first couple of years really has been spent doing a lot of looking at hiring practices. Mm-hmm. What are we doing in terms of recruitment and retention of faculty and staff? And so that's been the primary focus. Right now, we're actually working on a manual for hiring so that we can make sure that across the board, as we're looking at candidates for all positions, that we're having some consistency in those regards. So for us, a lot of the emphasis really has been on focusing on faculty and staff recruitment. And, you know, similar to what's going on at Brockport, we'll probably talk a little bit about this moving forward. SUNY initiated something called Prodigy this last year, which is geared very specifically to increasing faculty diversity. And so that is an area specifically that, you know, we're focused on from a SUNY standpoint, and that's being trickled down to the respective campuses. How do we build a capacity for faculty with the goal of reaching 1,000 underrepresented faculty and staff by 2030? That's the goal. So that's the work that we're focused in on right now.
All right. Briefly want to tell you about an event that Nazareth is hosting on Friday. Kamau Bell is coming, and it's called the W. Kamau Bell Curve, Ending Racism in About an Hour, 7:30 at the Callahan Theater in the Arts Center. Tickets still available?
Tickets are still available.
And if you don't know Kamau Bell, it'll be worth your while. It'll
absolutely
be worth the money.
Yeah. Absolutely. We are definitely kicking off with Bell prior to MLK, and please come on out if you don't know his work. it's not that he's a social commentarist, but he's also a comedian. And to be able to do both of those and do it successfully is not easy to do. But he looks at social structures as well as identity. How do individuals fit into that identity? And so he takes risk in looking not just at, again, underrepresented populations, but how do we think about this work in community with each other? So come on out.
All right. That is Friday night. Tickets still available and more info at artcenter@nas.edu if you want information there. So let me kind of ask, you know, specifically, and I'll start with you on this, Cephas.
Okay.
When we look at the work that you're all doing in various campuses, I mean, there's different needs in different places, but generally speaking, on the American campus, if we can talk about it as a monolith, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, a lot less focus on fixing this. But, well, let's also be honest, a lot of the people who are trying to figure out how to fix this are generally older, white, male, leadership at different institutions, you know, trying to bring in more voices to kind of figure out, well, what have we done to sort of inflame things? What needs to change here? You want to offer kind of a grade on where we are and how much work you think still has to be done?
Yeah, so I think you bring up a valid point. I would say, so one of the things that I have been working on, well, let me respond to your statement first,
yeah.
Is that I do think that there has been some progress, and there has been an intentional emphasis to tackle these things. What I will say is that oftentimes we are missing critical stakeholders from the table when we are making the decisions about how to collectively make change. And what I mean by that is that you talked about leadership. And so that word leadership is critical because literally there was an article that was written in the Chronicle of Higher Education. And it was, I think, a month and a half ago. And it talked about why diversity initiatives fail. That was the specific title of the article. And what it focused on was exactly the words you said, leadership, and the role of our leaders being willing to make the decisions. It talked about how, you know, many times we go and we offer implicit bias or unconscious bias training, and that's great. But what do you do when you only are given training? The article specifically, and I love this statement, it kind of highlighted, was that sometimes you need to make conscious bias interventions. Which means once you see that there is something being done that is negatively biasing the community, make a decision and address it versus say, well, we're going to just do implicit bias training. And so to really move that needle forward, we're going to have to develop these expectations with our leaders, starting off with making sure that our leadership areas reflect the members of the community that we wish to support the decisions that they make. And so it's looking at our governing boards, it's looking at our governing structures, and looking around the room and saying, who is missing from this table? Because when you make decisions that impact everybody, but there are only certain people who are at the table who get to make those decisions, then you create opportunities for the community members who you're asking to live and support them. It's challenging for them to do so. And so I think that there is becoming a more intentional effort to say, how are we making sure that the governing structures that are in leadership represent the people and the values and the lived experiences of those that they are going to be impacting? And I think that's a great area to really start on how that's really going to be a systemic change.
The article you're referencing has the following line. I'm going to read it because it's pretty damning. Symbolic gestures and millions of dollars can't overcome apathy.
Absolutely.
The implication is, you know, that not everybody, but the implication is in a lot of places, it's like, well, I guess we got to do our diversity thing now. Let's throw millions of dollars. We'll call this a big campaign. Won't that placate people?
Sure.
Which is not serious work.
Absolutely. And so for me, I would rather you, if I was ever given a choice, I'd rather you reflect me amongst the decision-making body than for you give me a couple of $100 to go do a program. Because that won't create systemic change, where it's the expectation of all of us to embody this work, where it becomes a part of our policies, our fundraising, our curriculum. The people who are sitting at those tables who make these decisions must be willing and capable of saying, we will. I think that because of access and technology, we have truly become a globalized world. When I was a kid, we didn't have cell phones and computer access where I could email or talk to somebody across the world. That's different today. And so how how are we actually creating structures, processes, people, funding streams, curriculum that reflect that our community neighborhoods are no longer just the 10 people that we affiliate with every day?
So let me follow up with Cephas, and we'll hit everybody on this because he's bringing this up. So let's hit this here. It was 2016, we did a series of reporting on the lack of teachers of color in public schools K through 12. And it, even for people who expected there to be a lack of diversity reflected, it was pretty severe. I can't tell you how many times I have heard from decision makers that you're talking about, board members of different places, CEOs, sometimes school superintendents. So people who are decision makers in various organizations. I'm not just talking about universities like MCC, RIT, NAS, Brockport, but companies, et cetera. And they'll often say something that sounds like this. Do you really think we don't want people of color on our board? Do you really think we don't want to hire teachers of color? Do you really think we don't want management of color? Sometimes, if you don't have any candidates in an applicant pool, what can you do? I hear that over and over again. See if it's already shaking your head over there, but let's since you brought this up, let's start with you. I want to get everybody's take on this because I hear it all the time.
Sure. Well, sometimes
you don't accept that. It sounds
absolutely. I do not. Sometimes our actions speak so loud that often people cannot hear the words we say. So when you say these are your priorities and your values and your goals, but yet they are not reflected in where your dollars are going. So are you looking at creating personnel and structures in place? If you realize that they're not applying to your online site, go out to where they are. Actually bring in diversity recruitment specialists like we have at the college now. Dr. Sandra Vasquez is outstanding, where she goes and travels to other colleges where we are graduating PhD students and faculty that are immediately qualified, so that if you say it's something you really want, then how are our actions really, our funding, our resources, our priorities, our strategic plans actually supporting that which we say is what we want? And so this is where, again, we're sending a message whether we are aware that we're sending it or not. But when we say these things and our actions don't support them, then it's often sometimes bring disconnect between us and our stakeholders.
Okay, Diane, what do you say to that?
I would say yes to all. And I think going back to education, when you talk about senior leadership and these priorities that maybe they're not understanding it fully, you have to go back to where they're at. And I know that this is hard. Change is hard overnight. How do you benchmarking and looking at if you have so many faculty that you want to recruit, and let's say health sciences and nursing is saying I can't find them, then you've got to be able to get them to places and start to be strategic about it. That to do it overnight, there has to be planning with that as we do strategic planning for everything else.
Absolutely.
So if you're looking for increasing numbers, you have to say, where are those openings 5 years from now, 6 years from now, and plan for that, like we plan for everything else in higher education.
Okay.
You know, once upon a time at RIT, diversity danced outside of strategic plans. And that was that it was an initiative that was, you know, in step with the strategic plan, but it was not a part of. That's today, true. We operate in a structure where institutional infrastructure is important, where the diversity initiatives are embedded directly in the strategic plan. So what we mean by that is that we have a board of trustees, for example, at RIT. In the board of trustees, there is a diversity committee that oversees all of our initiatives as they relate to diversity and inclusion at RIT. When we talk about faculty recruitment, when we talk about access and success of not only faculty, but also staff, as well as students, it's important that we establish true goals that are clearly articulated in the strategic plan that we can move towards in accomplishing those goals in a set period of time. Casting the net wider, I have to go back to that. We must be intentional in casting that net wider. When we say that we cannot find qualified individuals to fill certain positions, at RIT we do a mid-search process where we come back to the table. We look at, number one, how we have cast that net. Has it been cast wide enough? Have we gone to the populations that we're really trying to recruit? And if we have not been successful in attracting those individuals into that applicant pool, then we go back to the drawing board with that. That means that in some cases, searches do not move forward unless we have a diverse pool to begin to pull from. So that becomes very important in terms of not only our staff, not only our faculty, but also in terms of our students who come. But I think, you know, another part of that is the success of those individuals once they arrive on that campus. It is not enough for us to invite individuals in into climates where they cannot be successful. Mm-hmm. Tenure and promotion mm-hmm. matters. So they must be granted tenure and promotion in the process. Students must graduate on time. So we're not talking about students who are at institutions of higher learning for longer periods of time, but we want to close those graduation gaps. So when we start talking about our strategic initiatives, part of that is closing the graduation gaps that exist so that students are success as well as staff on our campuses.
Okay, Dr. Gant.
And, you know, I can't even echo more, you know, the things that are being discussed amongst the group. But certainly the part about the intentionality has to definitely be there. I go back to even the subject areas where we have the majority of students graduating. If you happen to have a sociology department, for example, and the majority of the folks that are teaching sociology do not look like the students that are graduating from that department. I'm sorry. In America, there's a plethora of sociology folks with PhDs. You know, so again, we there are ways to be able to go in and do that recruitment. Are you partnering with predominantly Black colleges and universities, mm-hmm. Hispanic-serving institutions? So there are intentional ways to be able to really take your job descriptions and be able to go after what it is that you're looking for. Again, you won't necessarily be able to do it for every single position, but again, if there was a way to tie all funding to increasing the diversity of the folks in your respective department or division, I think we would be able to find a way to make that happen. Mm-hmm. So again, it's that intentionality and also looking at the fact that those that are making the decisions, if you are chief diversity officer and you're not on the executive team for your institution is failing. That's the bottom line.
Absolutely.
If you are not on the executive team
Absolutely.
For your institution,
Absolutely.
Then your institution has not committed to diversity.
All right, so before only break of the hour, Dr. Archie, again, I'm looking at some of the reactions. This is where I wish we had Facebook Live up and running yet. We're about a month away from that, so you dodged that.
Absolutely.
But what is a giveaway that an institution is not serious about this kind of work?
I think some of the things that you said. So it's making it that it's the work of the people who are living the experiences every day. And what I mean by that is that diversity work will never be successful under any arena if it's only the people who are of diverse populations who are leading that charge. Slavery did not end because slaves alone wanted it to end. Slavery ended when people who were not slaves said, "We too say this is wrong." And so for institutions who have embedded the content and the language of "we," diversity is not just about underrepresented groups. It is not just for some of us. Diversity finds ways to benefit all of our community members and stakeholders. And how are we intentional driving that message? Have we defined what diversity is? Have we given equity and inclusion definitions so that we can emplace these things in our onboarding processes so that every student, every faculty, every staff member who comes into our institution recognizes what we qualify these things to be? And so it becomes the success when it has become a part of everything we do versus the optional for some of us to pick up because it actually involves our lives. And so that's a true metric of saying this is where the institution has become serious about it, developing it as an expectation for all community members.
Okay. Well, after our only break of the hour, we'll come back and talk a lot more about the work that they're doing on the various campuses at Brockport, at MCC, at RIT, at Nazareth College. The panel doing the kind of work that, as Sivas mentioned, you can say you're serious about it, but what is truly reflected in the work? And what are the actual outcomes? Are you measuring it? Are you serious about it? Are you just throwing money at it and calling it a campaign and then moving on to other things? Every campus now, I think, is addressing this in different but much more serious ways. So Dr. Sivas Archie, Dr. Calvin Gant, Dr. Keith Jenkins, Diana Riza, all here from their various campuses talking about that and more. Let's get that break and come right back on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Wednesday on The Next Connections, we're talking tariffs, and in particular, pretty soon, when you go to the wine store, you could see much higher prices. What's going on with wine tariffs and other tariffs in our first hour. In our second hour, Brexit and Megxit, or whatever they're calling the Harry and Meghan Markle exit, understanding the latest in UK culture, second hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. So during a brief break, we were just talking a little bit about the recent news out of Syracuse, in which there are 19 demands and 19 sort of changes that students and these united groups asked the administration to make. I'm not going to read through all of them, but I'll just sort of try to summarize. There's what they called their short-term list of demands, which involved the kinds of punishment for students who have found to violate the student code of conduct regarding racism, the kind of training for staff members, particularly for staff members who don't have tenure. And then there's long-term demands, which include things like a housing portal implemented as an option in the roommate selection process to allow future residents to choose roommates based on mutual interest and identities, as well as the expansion and promotion of multicultural learning communities to more residence halls on campus. They're talking about hiring more counselors that better represent all marginalized identities on campus. They're talking about allocating necessary funds to support students of color in alleviating financial burdens, doing more of that. And then there, of course, is hiring and the kind of work involved with hiring and training. So a long sort of set there, and SU has essentially said we'll take 16 of the 19 at face value. We're going to tweak the other three, but we want to work with you. Diane, during a brief break, you said, you know, a lot of different campuses have had to react to incidents. There's a difference between sort of reactive and proactive work. What do you make of what you've heard from Syracuse so far?
I mean, I think that with Syracuse or other institutions, we all learn from those experiences. I would say that in being proactive, I can speak to a president, Dave Braveman, who has been meeting with students since his legacy. I mean, one of his legacies, or at least his leadership, is to always be in contact with students. And so he meets with multicultural organizations ongoing. This is not when something bad happens, is let me talk about when things good happen. So that's the being proactive. I still go back to the curriculum and education, that how much of are we not systematizing in our curriculum and providing hands-on outside of the classroom experience where students can really responsibly, you talked about intentionality. How do we talk about these difficult conversations? We're seeing them nationally. We're seeing them led by, and I don't want to get into politics here, but we know what's going on in places with comments that we never thought would have been heard of in a such comfortable way. How do we pause with these conversations and have dialogue that we may disagree, but how can we do this respectfully? So, I mean, we put a intergroup dialogue in place that we're going to call, you know, we're going to grow that with our courses so that there is dialogue inside of the classroom and outside. But it's always being ahead of the game and really trying to be, I use the word strategic, but intentional strategy.
Dr. Jenkins, what do you make of what you've seen out of Syracuse?
You know, the key thing is, regardless of how they arrived at this space that they're in now, it is the commitment going forward that must be exercised. And I'll go back to RIT. I mentioned commitment over time. It started with President Rose. And I can even go back to even before President Rose. 1966, the federal government decided to fund a grant for the establishment of the National Technical Institute for the Deaf, which was established in 1968 at RIT. That's probably one of the more visible ways that we see diversity and experience diversity at RIT. But when you go from that president to Al Simone, to Dessler, to Munson, who is our current president at RIT, there has been sustained commitment. And so whatever Syracuse does, it must be that sustained commitment to those initiatives going forward. The intergroup dialogues must take place. But when you talk about training, we have a director of diversity education, for example, who is very much involved with faculty, with staff, with students in terms of educating about issues of diversity and inclusion. So it's that sustained commitment over time that is going to bring about the real results.
Okay.
If I could add something to that, and I certainly agree with you on the opportunities for training, et cetera, but I go back to my statement on the expectation of all. Because often we can have as many trainings and student programs and faculty learning opportunities to increase curriculum. But if these are not expectation of all of our community members, most often what we find is that the people that show up are the very same people that always show up. And so if we're only reaching those small pockets of people that are already, this is their research, this is their data, this is their lived learning experiences every day, then we're not really making a systemic change, because the people who probably need those developmental training opportunities most are absent. And so how are we developing the expectations to push that forward, that this must become the value and the expectation of all of us to increase these competencies to really bring about the culture that Dr. Ariza spoke of and the climate that she mentioned earlier? Because to develop and bring in all of these programs, a new faculty, a new staff, but we have not created the cultural climates at the institutions yet to be able to have them stay once they get there, then we are still not being as preventative as we could be to help them stay once they arrive.
Well, go ahead.
Yeah. No, if I can add to that, because I actually agree with that particular statement, and I would argue that when diversity and the initiatives of diversity rest only with chief diversity officers,
yes,
or a division of diversity and inclusion, then we're missing the mark. So I definitely agree. What we're looking at, even at RIT, is diversity and those initiatives flowing through every division at the institution, every college at the institution. And I think it must rest with the responsibility being in every college, every division, in order for us to effectively move forward.
You want to add to that?
Right. And, you know, one of the things that I say all the time, especially about MCC, you know, we talk about putting your money where your mouth is. Mm. You know, our executive team at the institution is 13 people, 6 of whom are African-American. So, mm-hmm. you know, so, okay, at the leadership level, there is that. Mm-hmm. But still, we're having an experience where students of color are not as successful from graduation standpoint. The returning of faculty is not as successful as we would like. So it can't just rest even with the executive team. It really does have to be fueled through all initiatives for the institution. It has to be an ongoing part of when we think about the retention, recruitment, the tenure process. Are there things embedded in your tenure review process that are inherently biased towards individuals of color being able to successfully move forward? Mm-hmm. So it's when you're looking at all of those different aspects, when you look at your syllabus, are you adding terminology in your syllabus that has nothing that is reflective specifically of what the actual course demands?
And
why are you doing that?
And I think we would all agree that all of us are different learners. We can't expect our faculty to be similar learners, that a sociologist is going to think about this work differently than a biologist.
Absolutely.
And a chemist. So that mm-hmm. we have to use vocabulary and language where we can educate as well, so that they're sensitized, so that that choir, those same folk appearing at these sessions, we start to diversify that.
And let me key in on something Dr. Jenkins mentioned. When you talk about getting that work to flow throughout the institution, not just
yes.
siloed in a quote-unquote diversity office, mm-hmm. let's be specific about one area where that may make an impact. Because Syracuse is dealing with this, but this is something that we focused on in 2016 when we did our series on diversity or lack of diversity in public schools. And look, I don't mean to pick on one district, but this is just what came up in our reporting, and I'm sure this is in a lot of places. So Pittsford Central Schools, well-regarded school district, but not a whole lot of diversity on its reading list at the time. I haven't been there in several years to see if the reading lists have changed, so I'm certainly open to that. Again, we're talking about one moment in time several years ago. Not a lot of diversity on its reading list. You know, so I'm thinking about what Stephen King, the author, said today, got himself in a bit of a kerfuffle on social media when he's responded to, well, the Oscar lists are out. And some people are looking at the Oscar list going, that's pretty white again, you know, once again. And Stephen King's response was, we've got to judge art on its own merits. We can't just walk in with quotas. And people are going, dude. Now, Stephen King has sort of walked it back And I think he's heard from a lot of people today. But this idea that a reading list in high school, the curriculum at a university, what's taught, who's doing the teaching, whether it's novels that are assigned, whether it's different material, historical events, history textbooks. It's not just a matter of, well, if it's the best stuff, it'll land in class. Sometimes you have to be intentional.
That's right.
Because there is, obviously, whether it's good art or important history, it matters who is selecting the material. And that's something that the SU students have said and part of their demands. We want the curriculum reflected. So let me go around the table, and I'll start with Dr. Archie on this. How do you reflect curriculum?
Oh, boy. Here you go. You always start with Dr. Archie. There are three other qualified people around
We're going in a circle.
You're fine. So for me, this is a very good topic for us because our college has done some great work with this. So we have something called, and we've had it for a while, it's called a diversity student learning outcome. And so there are specific courses at the college that qualify for the diversity student learning outcome based off of what's in the curriculum, the specific assignments that are taught. And what we realized about 2 years ago is the last time that diversity student learning outcome rubric had been updated was almost 20 years ago. And so there's been a lot that has changed in the world of diversity, equity, and inclusion, intersectionality, implicit bias, all of these great things. And so working with our college senate, because again, at our college, if the CDO is the only person talking about inclusion, we will fail. And so working with our college senate, Jim Zolweg, and working with Dr. Jennifer Ashton, our leaders of our PCDI, we worked with our faculty and said and brought in our students. We brought in the Office of Assessment so that we were using things to quantify the outcomes that we were expecting so that they were measurable things that we could assess. And so what we did is we worked with our college senate, and they were glad to do so collaboratively to revise and update that diversity student learning outcome so that if a student, first off, we require that all students who retain a degree from our college are required to take at least one D course or a diversity student learning outcome course so that now it's embedded in the expectation of all students. Now, students can pick what area of diversity. It could be women and gender studies. It could be religion. It could be race or African and African American studies based. But there are specific things that those courses must teach which incorporate intersectionality. Intersectionality is important because when you start talking about the right to vote, women got the right to vote in, was it 1919, later ratified in 1920. But if you teach that only women and not where gender and race intersect, you wouldn't know that it was only white women that got that right to vote. So it's being more intentional to say, where do these specific diverse groups even intersect? And having that be a part of the curriculum that our students take with these courses. And that's what we mean by developing collaborative, diverse expectations of all of our students that provide them those competencies and knowledge going forward. So that's how we're looking at our curriculum and making sure that it reflects that.
Okay, Diane.
We are currently looking at that more intentionally, have a task force made up of different disciplines. And I go back to this being not just interdisciplinary, but very focused on how would social sciences be different from health sciences, be different from business, and how they look at this work is different. But the outcomes, you know, going back to Archie, the outcomes, the diversity learning outcomes have to be in place. You know, I'm a sociologist in training, and I've been a professor for many years, taught introduction to ethnic studies. I had students that majored in ethnic studies at another institution. And I will say that when, and there's proof to this, when you have students engaged in this work inside and outside of the classroom, in majors or minors, more intentional, the outcomes, there is more clarity, more understanding of the work in their disciplines. So if you have more courses within business, or you have more courses, I keep calling it threading, how do you think about this work in general education, but how do you do that more intentionally with majors and minors?
Okay, Dr. Jenkins.
Yeah, unless someone jolts me awake, I am unable to teach what I do not know. Yes. And what I mean by that is that even though we may desire that individuals have curriculums that are inclusive, unless I know that I'm missing the mark, I need someone to assist me with making sure that I hit the mark.
Absolutely.
And so you have a number of initiatives that are underway now at RIT. For example, CASEL, which is the Center for Advancing STEM, Teaching, Learning, and Evaluation, that really raises awareness for the faculty in that particular college so that they can advance in terms of creating a more inclusive curriculum. There are other initiatives, the College of Science HHMI grant. That's the Howard Hughes Medical Institute grant. They secured one of these grants for the sole purpose of educating faculty first, as well as establishing those relationships with students. Why do I mention some of these particular initiatives? Primarily because if I don't know, then I need to have my awareness raised. And I think that we have to start with faculty, and particularly those who have been with us for a long time, and educate so that we can more greatly diversify those curriculum.
Dr. Gant?
Right. In an ideal situation, what I would love to see if we were able to create, you know, a unique opportunity for those that are in the leadership, not only for the institution, but for faculty and staff, is that we establish a mentoring program where you're actually mentoring other faculty and staff of color to come into those organizations. Mm-hmm. Because those, you know, when you look at the leadership most of the time for those different groups, it's predominantly Caucasian.
Right.
So is there an opportunity to be able to pull someone up who is a newer, younger staff member to help them to understand what it means to be a part of that kind of system and leadership to be able to develop that? You know, faculty own the curriculum to a degree, right? They run the curriculum. They get to decide the things that are going to happen from a faculty standpoint. So again, it's wonderful, you know, and I'm having those conversations with individuals about the things that I'm seeing. But that has to be something that's coming from the faculty side, something that's being led by individuals, again, not only from these liberal arts disciplines, but also from the science disciplines.
That's
There's
right.
plenty of information that's out there about diversity as it relates to biology and the sciences and nursing and those types of things. Clara Barton didn't just fall out of the sky. You know, so there are opportunities for us to be able to do that. But again, unless it's your lived experience, do you see it as valuable addition to what the student experience is going to be like?
All right, about a minute apiece then, and I'll start here. Cephas, I'll start here. I'm going to finish with you. I'm going to finish with Cephas. He's
going to
back
clean
up. So, Dr. Gant, if each of you can just give me about a minute summation, and if we sit down in 5 or 10 years from now, what are the signs, what are the indicators that you're going to feel good about the work that you're doing and that it's successful on your campus?
Well, definitely that having an increase in the number of faculty of staff and staff of color. I mean, staff for us is already at a higher rate than we have faculty, but really some commitment, and I'm going to put a quantifying number on it, 20% increase in faculty of color. That's a number that, you know, I would be really excited about.
Okay, in 30 seconds, give me some other benchmarks or ideas that you want to, that would make you feel like it's been successful.
Well, I think, you know, right now we have the Diversity Council. We have the Dr. Alice Holloway Young Diversity Internship Program. All different initiatives through our institution that we're trying to increase diversity for people even outside the institution. If you're not from a community college and you think you might be able to come and have an impact, this is a way for a road in. So how are we connecting with our greater community? That's something we've been working on together. We're trying to figure out how do we have a greater impact, not just on our students, but the campus or the community at large.
All right, Dr. Jenkins at RIT, 1 minute. What's the answer?
I would say when I look at our diversity index, and the diversity index is a model that we use at RIT to examine the probability that if any two persons are chosen at random, what is the likelihood that they would be of a different racial or ethnic background? Right now, for our students at RIT, they stand a 47% chance that they will interface with someone who will be of a different background if any two are chosen at random. What's lacking is closing that gap for our faculty and our staff. We know that we will always be more diverse with a younger population, but the question for us is how tolerable is that gap for our faculty and for our staff. Our goal would be to close that gap so that we are closer in terms of the proximity to the students on that campus with the diversity index.
Representation. Diane at Nazareth, go ahead.
We just unveiled a campus climate survey last semester for faculty and staff. And I would want to believe, 5 years later, I would want to say that the faculty that have been there have been tenured, as well as staff who have been at Nazareth for a long time, can say 5 years later that there is trust, that there is understanding of diversity, that there's understanding of what truly a community and belonging is. So that would be one. I would want to see those results look different 5 years later. Two, I would want to see a curriculum that truly is inclusive and represents our citizenry, our nation, and that when we're talking about preparing nurses, that we are really talking about how do we think about this work, that it no longer is, oh, I have to think about diversity in this moment, but that it's inclusive excellence. It's part of my makeup. That I'd like to see 5 years later in the number of courses we're offering and how students are learning.
Okay. 1 minute. Go ahead, Dr. Richard.
So for me, I would say that when I think about success, it takes me back to true Tinto. So Tinto talked about higher education integration. Mm-hmm. Tinto's research didn't talk about inclusion. It talked about integration, which means it's beyond inclusion, which means inclusion means I have somebody at the table who could represent this group's needs, or I have someone else at the table who could represent that group's needs. Integration means everybody at the table is looking out for everybody's needs, so that it's no longer just your needs and their needs, but what do we need as a community? And when I see that there is a discrepancy or a bias or a something that's impeding the success of one group, I take that on to say, hey, when you impact them, what happens to them impacts me. And that's really getting beyond sort of the only including, because including means you're represented. It doesn't mean that you're actually given a voice to have meaningful change. And it's really looking at all of those aspects of it from a systemic manner.
And in the same way that we would say, the word tolerance is really minimal.
Minimal benchmark.
No tolerance.
Yeah, but that's one way. Thank you for a robust conversation. Cephas, Calvin, Keith, Diane, representing Brockport, MCC, RIT, Nazareth College. Thanks to all of you for the work that you're doing on your campuses, and I hope we can stay in touch and continue these conversations.
Sure.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
And to the point made at the outset of the hour, we can keep having these conversations, but we all have to kind of keep doing the work in our own ways here. And we'll take that with us from this hour. Our thanks as well to Bob Volunteering. Megan Mack is the producer and the engineer. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a great afternoon. Talk to you tomorrow on Member Supported Public Radio.